Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine, and I'm delighted to be joined today by JJ Bull the Bullet. Hi, JJ.
Hello, Joe.
John McKenzie. Hi.
Oh, I don't get a nickname, do I? I see how it is.
Jonathan Ross Dog McKenzie is here. And of course, also joining us remotely today, all the way from the fennels of Cambridgeshire, it's Steve Hankles, the Hankle Man. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Joe.
That's right. Producer Steve here to guide us through the annals of football today as we discuss all things... all things football. What did we discuss today? Well, we started off by talking a little bit about Liverpool, a breaking news story occurring there. So by the time you listen to it, a day later, it will no longer be breaking. But it's breaking for us. And of course, also, we talk about Ralf Hasenhüttl saying goodbye to the Premier League sweet Austrian.
Keep going. That's funny.
Also, we talk about other things happen. All the football happened over the weekend. Tottenham, Liverpool, Arsenal, Chelsea.
Champions League draw.
Champions League. Oh, the Champions League draw happened while we were recording. We talk about that too, and all the feisty Europa League games coming up. Goodness me. It is a veritable feast of football on today's show. And, of course, we had a long conversation about Gabriel Jesus and his goal-scoring ability too. So there's that to look forward to for later.
Trendy things.
All the different kind of trendy things. That's right. John got upset because I laughed at him when he said he was trendy. But if you really want to get on top of the trends, then you need to visit theathletic.com. Theathletic.com/TIFO, where every football-related trend can be found and devoured by a hungry consumer base of football fans. Yes? Visit theathletic.com/TIFO, where the first story on today's docket, the Liverpool for sale story, was broken by Monsieur David Ornstein et al., others too. This is just a kind of place where we break news, guys. Hey, no big deal. No big deal. Let's not waste any further ado. Let's leave you in the warm hands and the cool embrace of FSG, and we'll talk about that momentarily. Yes, okay. First, a topic for the docket today. FSG appear to be putting Liverpool up for sale, John. What do you think about that?
Yeah, it seems interesting timing, doesn't it? Because obviously things have been a little bit funny around Liverpool at the moment. But yeah, it appears that after 12 years or so of owning the club, they're wanting to move it on. So it does throw everything up in the air a little bit. I think Liverpool have been associated with FSG, and I think FSG have been associated with a lot of Liverpool's successes as well. So a lot of uncertainty about what comes next, who comes next in terms of an owner, and I suppose what happens to Jurgen Klopp, who I think has been like the big thing that they did, right? That's the decision they made that they got right.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you that I'm reading from the copy of the Athletic's news story. Fenway Sports Group has put Liverpool up for sale. A full sales presentation has been produced for interested parties. FSG has looked at opportunities in the past, but has decided against moving forwards with them. It's unclear whether or not a deal will eventually be done, but FSG is inviting offers. JJ, do you think that Liverpool fans today might be a little concerned about the sort of group or organisation that might be in a position to buy such an expensive asset?
I think almost certainly you'd be concerned because there are only certain amounts of, well, certain parts of the world that are able to afford things now. I don't know. And yes. You've seen with lots of different owners who don't have the best interests of the club at hand, or they want to use it for certain maybe political reasons. It could be a thing you want to have. And if that's your club is what so many people in Liverpool are base everything around. You don't want to have any of those values altered or you know, directly or accidentally by anyone else coming in. Not to say that whoever comes in wouldn't have the best interests at heart, whoever wants to buy it. But I guess there's also the unrest of what happens with the people below that. And if it's been run so well for the last while and they've managed to get back to being one of the top European teams again.
Yeah.
If there's, I mean, often you see, there was a manager I spoke to once, I think I said this before in the podcast, that often what you see on the pitch is representative of what's happening behind the scenes at the very top. So if the very top's very organized and everything's in place there, then you can pretty much be sure that on the pitch you'll have a stable team that's been run well because it all goes through the entire club. So yeah. When you have a bit of disarray and you have people coming in who maybe bring in directors and everything doesn't make sense and there's a bit of lack of communication and there's all sorts of politics going within the club, you might start to see a bit of a mess on the pitch replicating what's there. I mean, that's pretty... You can't guarantee that's what's going to happen, but sure. That sort of thing has been mentioned to me before.
Here's some more information. FSG, of course, principally owned by John W. Henry, who is one of the two founders alongside Tom Werner. FSG also own the Boston Red Sox. They own television network NESN. They own 50% of Roush Fenway Racing and Fenway Sports Management. Roush. Maybe it's pronounced differently. But anyway, Roush, they own 50% of that.
Please stop saying that.
Roush. FSG sold an 11% stake in the company, $750 million, to Redbird Capital last year. Redbird, who were the investors, they now own AC Milan, don't they?
Yeah, I think they're in the ownership group that owns that. And Toulouse as well, I think.
Toulouse.
Redbird Capital are taking over sports clubs and running them according to data principles.
Mm.
So, yeah, which is something that we'll see happening more. I guess the idea there is that, you know, as we've already talked about, it's hard to make money in football. So the idea is this, if we use the data, we should be able to exploit market inefficiencies, etc. So,
sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I mean, the only other thing to speak about, I suppose, is Jurgen Klopp, who, you know, we spoke on last week's podcast before a couple of impressive wins about his, you know, his potential future. I have no idea whether this throws that into any...
I can only imagine it would possibly be up for doubt if certain owners were to come in that go against his ideologies and things he's spoken quite strongly about this week to do with the Qatar World Cup.
I suppose we'll follow the story more as we can. John, I think you're planning to interview someone from The Athletic about this very shortly, so if you're interested in more information about this, then check out those. Presumably by now uploaded a video about this on TIFA IRL. But for now, let's move on with the rest of the show. Okay, let's talk about Ralf Hasenhüttl, Dan Shelton and Jacob Tanswell of The Athletic, of course, confirmed, well, they wrote over the weekend and then on Monday confirmed that he has departed the club after nearly 4 years in charge at St Mary's, which for a Premier League manager is a rather long time, we should say.
I actually spoke to a friend about the Southampton sacking.
Oh, that's not on the plan. Okay.
Well, asking how he thought about it. Do you want me to play it?
Yeah.
I don't think I've got the volume on.
This is a successful start, isn't it?
Yes, this is good. I do have the volume on.
Yeah.
Take two.
I mostly feel sad because I like Ralph, but I think we've lost our sense of identity. The pressing's diminished. And although we've recruited good young players, people like Lavia and Bazuno, it feels like the club's kind of drifting a bit. I'm surprised perhaps that the new ownership didn't adjust things sooner. But Ralph has been a long-serving and generally admired manager, except for the last couple of seasons. So yeah, I think it's sad.
Who's that?
That's Alex Stewart.
Alex who?
You know, the guy you fired.
Alex Stewart?
Yeah.
Do you remember him?
Yeah, he was really nice. You fired him. Do you remember? And you said, if you don't leave now, I'm going to follow you to your house. I'll track you down.
I've no memory of that person.
It was in the night. You howled and then sort of... You stretched your arms like, you know, like all big, and there's a big howl into the moon, and then you disappeared. And I heard that there was some sort of disturbance at Alex Stewart's house.
Right.
Yeah. You definitely know who he is.
We sorted you out. There. Sounds got like your clothes back on and
decent
got
take,
you to bed,
I suppose, it isn't it? Yeah.
You know, I said sometimes you're two people. I think maybe this was the
one of the other.
the other one. This was cruel.
Well, all I can say is that he sounds like a very nice person.
Not having the crow thing.
Can't no idea.
You wouldn't know who Crow is, I guess.
Who's Crow?
It's the other one of you.
Oh.
It's Joe and Crow.
Right. Joe and Crow.
Yeah.
Yeah. What do you think about Ralf Hasenhüttl being let go, though, John? It feels like it's sort of something that's kind of been oft thought might happen and now has happened.
Yeah, I mean, as you mentioned before, I think Alex mentioned the new ownership have come in.
Who? And sorry, go on. I don't mean to derail.
New ownership has come in, and I think whenever that happens, it's always tricky to keep a coach that's been on before, because you're always going to be expected to... you're always going to be held to account for anything that happens. And if you don't change the manager, it can become tricky. But obviously, Hasenhüttl was there for a while, and I think he adopted a way of playing that I think has since been questioned. You know, that the sort of Red Bull style hasn't really worked so well in the Premier League. And this season, they tried to change things up a bit. So not only did they bring in younger players, as Alex mentioned, but they started trying to play less aggressive.
I mean, there was a new coaching staff as well, wasn't there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
They were trying to switch their play style. And I guess the issue is always going to be, like, if you're going to try and switch your play style away from what is Hasenhüttl's specialism, then why not just bring in a coach who is able to coach that play style as a starting point?
Well, let me tell you this. As part of the club's statement, they said Hasenhüttl, who was appointed in December 2018, departs having made a significant contribution to the club, overseeing some memorable results. And you laugh because, like, because the 2-9-0s, presumably, and I think this potentially unfair to Hasenhüttl, probably will come to define his time there. How fair a reflection do you think that will be if in 5 years' time we remember Ralf Hasenhüttl as the guy who lost 9-0 twice?
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it? Because if he'd have lost one 7-0 and the other one 10-0, people wouldn't remember it. It's the fact that they both landed on the same number. But yeah, I think it's important to say that Hasenhüttl did a good job. He kept a team in the Premier League for a long time who weren't spending a lot of money. I mean, they were making decent money through transfers. They were bringing players in for 10, 15 million and selling them for 20, 25 million. And that, when that's the context within which you're operating as a manager, I think staying in the league is impressive because you're constantly sort of fighting against all of the odds to stay there. So I think it's worth saying that. But at the same time, I think the new ownership clearly want to take a different track now.
Yeah.
I think, and we're seeing that happening more and more now, is that owners of clubs, especially in the Premier League, want to compete. And I know that sounds ridiculous because it's probably never been harder to compete in the top division. But it will be interesting to see how they go from here.
That's someone trying to get in.
Yeah.
It's Crow.
It's Crow. It's Alex Stewart trying to get back in.
You buried him underneath the floor. This is, I'll try and make this relevant. I was thinking about who to go as on Football Manager this year, and I was thinking Southampton might be quite a good save because it's a real challenge, right? It's a low budget. They've got decent young players coming through. I mean, that's their whole model is you buy low, sell high.
Right. Back to John and JJ's business class right there, isn't it?
Yeah. Actually, we have a different module, which is buy high, sell low.
Right, okay.
It's less successful.
But it's you're going to work out one day, though. One day that plan is going to come good.
I do like that bit of the course. So they have good young players, and it's a big club. You know, it's lots of history and whatever you want, so all the things you want to have in it. And then I thought, but what's really the point? Because as soon as you got them good, it would take a good 4 or 5 years of buying Brazilian wonder kids before you can make them anywhere decent.
That's true.
And then really, it's just Man City, Newcastle, Man United will just own the world forever because they've got all the money. Like, soon it'll become like, I was thinking this, I'm quite negative this morning, but the Premier League will just turn into like every other league where there's just two big teams that beat everything because they've got all the money. It'll change then again.
I'm not sure that's true, though. I mean, part of the idea, surely, is that the Premier League kind of is becoming the Super League, and the idea that there are big players who are choosing to go to Premier League mid and lower leagues, lower table sides than our Europa League teams in the rest of Europe.
But the scales of it, right? Because I mean, I agree with that, obviously, but I think the Premier League is probably the only league that can survive that right now. But it can't be coincidental that there are... I mean, the league has got two teams that always win it. Atletico did well to try and challenge it for a while. They seem to have fallen away. And then Germany, Bayern Munich will win it forever and ever. France, PSG occasionally get knocked out with someone else because it must be quite funny to beat them in France, and that's why it works there. So, I mean, eventually over time, say 5-10 years, it might end up being that this is what's happening. It's happening in front of us very slowly, very stealthily. It's just what's happening. So it'll be
It's just a Gulf State proxy war.
Yeah, just be like in the Scottish Premiership, where you've got, they're not owned by the Gulf States, but, you know, Celtic Rangers are so far ahead of anyone else, you can't touch them. Sure enough, Rangers lost to St. Johnstone yesterday, but it doesn't really matter. But, like, they'll still be top forever. And then Premier League... I wonder if that will happen. I hope not.
Maybe. Can I tell you who my shout is for a Football Manager save for this new... I think you've just wobbled John's camera there.
He's just trying to erase me from...
He doesn't want you to be part of this.
Cray Cray is onto it.
He got rid of Alex, and now he wants to, like, shift me out.
He's Crow.
Yeah, maybe he is.
Jamie's tripping over some stuff. I'll carry on talking as we reshuffle the camera. So if you hear some mechanism noises in the background, don't worry, it's just our in-house robot, Jamie, who's fixing things. My shout for an FM save for the new game, Barcelona. I think that's the best one because they've got fuck all money, right? So after year one, you're going to have to sell players, and it's like it's quite a pure rebuild job. Add a club that are still amazing and still have amazing players, and in the future would have lots of money. Surely that'd be fun.
Well, I did it last season. I did it last year.
Did you?
Yeah, and I thought the same thing. It would be really difficult. It was easy.
Right.
I won the league easily because I'm amazing at it.
I see.
Also, it just was easier, and then suddenly you have money.
Yeah.
It works out in the end for them, it turns out.
Can I say, if you want to hear more about doing a Barca save, according to Steve Hankels, you can listen to this week's FM pod from The Athletic. He hasn't finished typing the sentence. What a shame. We'll never
know.
He's
put an ellipsis there, so you have to go athletic.
Yeah. And then look at the camera.
That, yeah,
but if we do stay on Hasenhüttl, like he did, I think, must have overperformed slightly because they didn't have a great team for a long time. And when you have players who aren't as good as other teams, I think having a clear branded style of football is one way to make sure that you have identity within the league, but also just a way of beating people that isn't... If you do like a Mark Hughes and you turn up and you just have some players on the pitch and hope they do all right because they've got good players, it doesn't work. And it's very stylized. And it was fun to watch. I thought for a while, I thought he really could be... If they'd invested in him and kept going up and up and up, he might have been able to be something special.
This is the thing, isn't it? Like I see a tweet here from Tommy LUFC, who says that Rangnick and Hasenhüttl both tried to implement variations of the Red Bull system in the PL to little success. That's true, but also it feels a little disingenuous because Rangnick was in an extremely difficult situation. And I think if anyone listening has read the long reads from The Athletic about the inside track of his time there, they will appreciate why perhaps it's not that straightforward to implement a new system at Manchester United, or at least it wasn't for him at the time. And with Hasenhüttl, as we've said several times already, his squad wasn't invested in. And presumably, John, a big part of the Red Bull ethos when it comes to those two clubs, even though I know people hate it when we say Red Bull ethos, the RB ethos is investment, even if it is on a smaller scale, even if it's very, very smart scouting. I mean, is it fair to judge that type of football, Jesse Marsh, of course, also part of this, when the context of those two results are such?
I guess the issue comes down to what the fans expect from watching a team, right? And if you feel as though your team is just a cipher for a big corporation to either sell their product or make money, and you don't enjoy the football and you don't feel as though there's any... Because that's where Tommy goes on in that tweet. He says, for me, this is the elephant in the room. I don't mind our staff or players talking about Leeds. I'm just not convinced by the system in terms of its usefulness at this level.
And
that's where it comes down to, because I think the big question then becomes, is this a long-term strategy which will actually get your team to the level that the fans want them to be at? And obviously, fans of Leeds see them as being a sleeping giant, regardless of whether or not anyone else agrees. But the idea that we can sort of shithouse our way to 14th place this season to stay in the league is probably not, in the long term, a particularly attractive proposition to Leeds fans. And that's where we're seeing this cultural divide now in the Leeds fan base. You get people on the one side saying, oh, you've got short memories. It wasn't that long ago when we were in the Championship and everyone wanted to be in the Premier League. To people on the other side being like, if this is what the Premier League is, why are we so bothered about being here? Phil Hay wrote a really good piece on this recently, and he was saying, you know, we're told all the time that the Premier League is the big show. It's where we should want to be. But for the fans, it's not a particularly attractive experience, in which case, why are we being told that we must stay in this division at all costs if we enjoy the Championship
more? Listen,
more?
Uncle Damien loves it in the Championship with Norwich because his team win. And it's fun. I think he quite enjoys the sort of the refresh challenge, the up and down nature of it, because it also, he said when they went down to League One, what was that, about 8-10 years ago now, maybe? That was before Paul Lambert became, maybe longer, before Paul Lambert became the manager. After Norwich lost 7-1 to Colchester in League One, Paul Lambert was their manager. They took him and then got promoted twice in a row. But he said he had a lovely time that year. It was obviously disappointing, but he got to go to all these new grounds. He's a, in a way, travelling fan, a violent hooligan. is that okay to say? Obviously,
it's
not.
It's okay because he's
away
not
fans,
actually
a
violent
hooligan. Yeah, and the joke was about away fans being violent hooligans, and they're not, of course. But Uncle Damien very much is. If you see him in a town that isn't London, just stay out of the way, because your shop windows might be cracked.
Unless, of course, you go to the Old Red Line Theatre Pub in Angel, yeah. In which case he's the finest
landlord. A fiery thespian instead. He loves it there. Yeah. Absolutely adores it there. But seriously, though,
do go to the Red Line, but also do...
If you see him outside of London and Norwich, it's not worth it. It's really not. I think that's enough now. Let's talk instead about the Champions League, because the Champions League draw has occurred. It was occurring as we spoke. Now let's discuss it. I'll go through the games as they stand. RB Leipzig have drawn Manchester City, JJ. And it seems, I know that there's a kind of cliche here. There's a bit of a stereotype. There's a common said theme that Manchester City...
A conspiracy.
That's the word I was thinking for. Yeah. That Manchester City appear to get rather easy teams in the round of 16. I don't know whether that's true. I haven't done my research.
There's no easy games at this level, Joe.
RB Leipzig?
No easy games at this level.
It's one of the easier games.
Maybe. Also finished first in their group and got to play against someone who finished second in there.
That's true. Let's talk about the group
also,
that RB Leipzig
Guardiola has a habit of changing his tactics drastically against teams like this because he sees what their individual threats are, and then they tend to get little bits of joy against them.
Right, okay. Well,
this is a battle of cultures, isn't it, right? Yeah. This is Man City, the most sort of idealistic team in world football ever, perhaps. Yeah. And then RB Leipzig, who are, as we've already talked about, they're playing that style of play, which is designed to almost game the system a little bit. So it could be a fun game.
Do you think it will be interesting come February?
It's not the game I'll be watching, at least, no.
Okay.
But I think it could be interesting.
Let me predict the game that you'll be watching is Club Brugge versus Benfica.
That's right, you know me so well.
Can we just have a quick conversation about this as well? Because I've always said Club Bruges before, because, of course, the town or city in Belgium, it's a lovely place, I've been there, we call it Bruges. But apparently in football, you say Brugge.
Yeah, I believe it's in Flanders, isn't it?
In Brugge. Flanders, for the character from The Simpsons? Is that Flemish?
Yeah, so...
Flanders? Is that Flanders
Dutch,
Flemish?
It's the Dutch-speaking part of Belgium, or the Flemish-speaking part of Belgium. So I guess it's correct to call it by its Flemish name.
Brugge.
Yeah, whereas Anderlecht is in the French-speaking part. Is that right? No, maybe that's wrong as well. I think it's right. Liège is definitely in the French.
You don't appear to know, do you?
So you'd say Standard Liège.
Can I tell you a little fact about Belgium now?
No. Yes.
Well, I'll tell JJ.
It's yes and.
JJ, you know, of course, that Laurie Whitwell and Nick Miller of The Athletic are on a journey across Europe and Asia. They're driving. It's called Planes, Trains and Automobiles, and then the subtitle that I can't remember. But they are accompanied by our friend Martino Simsic, who's a fantastic video producer, videographer, used to work at Copa 90. I think was one of the people responsible for the Derby Days videos, if you remember those back in the day. Good fun stuff. He's following Nick and Laurie as they make their journey to Doha via various different means of transport. And they were having a lovely time. Everything got off to a great start until day 3 or 4, when all of the cameras were stolen on a train in Belgium between Anderlecht and somewhere, Brussels maybe.
Brugge.
It wasn't Brugge or anything. But poor guys, it was a busy commuter train apparently. And
that will have... not didn't mean to use this pun, that will have derailed the journalism.
Yes, I mean, luckily they found a fantastic camera shop in Amsterdam when they arrived, and have managed to replace all the equipment, which is great news.
That happened to Marc Rebier. He was doing a tour and someone nicked all the stuff out the back of his car. They just parked it for a bit.
Yes.
Had to go buy everything again.
There we go. Marc Rebier, the TikToker.
Rebier, he's not a TikToker.
Well, he got big on TikTok though, didn't he?
No, he got big on YouTube. He's streaming all the time. And
the
then
YouTuber.
Now he's now he can headline festivals. He's an enormous, enormous talent. He's great.
I think it was TikTok that made him big, really.
Marc Rebier, are you kidding?
Yeah, pretty sure it was TikTok.
No way.
Pretty sure TikTok he's on TikTok, 100% on TikTok.
Is he? It's, well, he's a content creator for that then, and he was YouTube. It doesn't matter.
Sure.
I mean, can I just say, Benfica are amazing. Video guy.
Yeah, what's the deal with Benfica? Because of all the group finishes that I noted as noteworthy, Benfica winning Group H, which included PSG, who came second, Juve, who finished third with 3 points, the same as Maccabi Haifa.
they finished top of that group because they scored loads of goals in the last game.
Did they indeed?
And I think they scored the last goal in injury time. I think it was a João Mário finish from like 25 yards, and it put them top of the group on What was it? It's not even goal difference. It was
well.
No, it was beyond that. It was like goals for or something.
Their
like
club executive. It was head to head. I think I thought it was.
It was away goals. That's what it was.
Well, yeah. that extra time or added time goal has proved to be extremely useful for Benfica, because PSG, who finished second, will be facing Bayern. So I'm sure the Benfica club executives will be sitting around rubbing their hands with glee. Why are you so excited about them?
Benfica? They're just really fun. So we're going to try and do a video on this on Tifo IRL soon. It is coming. People who keep asking in the comments, I'm doing it soon. But they've got really good players and they play a really good style of football. Roger Schmidt is the manager. He had a bit of a bad time somewhere. Where did he go? Ajax, and it didn't work out.
Was it PSV?
PSV. It was one of the Dutch teams, anyway.
It was at Feyenoord as well.
I can't remember.
I'll check this out because we should.
Thank you.
Like
it'd be good to have good knowledge in that rather than guessing. But the team plays really. They're really fun to watch. It's a 4-2-3-1, 4-4-2 sometimes. But they've got the players individually. Gonçalo Ramos is this young striker who's been linked with a lot of big clubs. He was heavily linked with Newcastle and I think Man United in the summer.
PSV.
David Neres, really good winger. Then there's this young guy, Antonio Silva, is this 18-year-old centre back. Who is another future wonder kid? João Mário, Alex Grimaldo at left back. Nicolas Otamendi still plays. He plays there. But they just play nice football. They keep the ball. They win it back. They score the goals. Right. They're just a decent team.
All things that football teams need to do to win games.
Yeah, I thought they outplayed PSG in the games that they played against them. I think they drew one of them or drew both. I can't remember. They drew both, I think.
I couldn't possibly tell you.
Well, they just looked solid for players who are not, like, we look at the team sheets in Benfica versus PSG, like, on paper clearly PSG are miles better,
sure,
but Benfica genuinely are like a team and they just seem to be better with the component parts than PSG.
Well, Porto won their group as well, which was Group B. Yeah, Club Brugge coming second in that, with Leverkusen and Atletico both out in third and fourth on 5 points. Again, I think that group, Porto, you perhaps expect. Leverkusen, Atletico, I think a bit of a surprise there. But on the Portuguese teams, John, I mean, what's happening? Is something happening in Portugal? We expect Porto to go through to the round of 16. Benfica as well feels, you know, it's quite exciting.
I'm not going to pretend I know much about Portuguese football, but someone who does know about Portuguese football is Thiago Estevão, mm-hmm. who is well known to people.
Sure.
Generally.
Thiago Estevão.
To people who don't know who he is, because I wouldn't know you guys.
He is, am I allowed to say what he is?
I don't know.
He's
a monster.
He works in football.
He works for a big football club.
Yes,
I think you can find out on the internet if you want to. It doesn't matter. He mainly plays Rocket League with us.
Yes, that's true. That's what he's most famous for.
Yeah. and he's absolutely fucking shit at that game. He's so bad at that game, and I hate him. But he's got really good football insights.
Yes, yeah. He has. He is Portuguese and he knows the league really well. And he said this has sort of been happening for a long time, that Portugal has been producing sides that get through in the group stages of the Champions League. And I guess this is the first time that two teams have finished top of their groups for a long time. It does indicate that something is happening in Portugal.
I just want to hammer home that it's not because he's your mate that he's got valuable information. It's because he is a scout at a high-level club. That's he's got valuable information.
Did it seem like we were saying because he was friends with us, he would know things?
No. I just want to make sure, because people who aren't people we know listen to this podcast sometimes.
Yeah. I think that was clear already. I mean, we said he worked for a major European club. Is your brain switched on? Is it switched off again? It happens sometimes. John, while I'm talking, will you just walk around the back and just wind him in the back?
I'm on the tube and all of a sudden, like, a tube stop just missed and I was just here. What's going on?
He is Crow.
He's Crow. Yeah, now we finally know what happened to Alex Stewart.
Blanks of memory that he can't.
Videos recently.
Speaking of Crow, it doesn't work at all.
Come on, you can do this. Make it work.
Speaking of Crow, a very intelligent animal, of course. And one of the most intelligent animals we know is Antonio Conte. He's a highly evolved intelligent animal. Does that work? Am sure. I in dodgy ground here?
No,
I think it's probably
in
fine.
In terms
isn't
of
it?
What, crows or Antonio?
In terms of mechanisms. Processes. Ruminations, not ruminations. What's how?
Is
I,
this, on
I just want this. I just want this segue to end.
How is
please.
It when they go forwards? You encouraged me. AC Milan are playing Tottenham, which is quite an exciting game. JJ, the winner of Serie A playing Tottenham.
Yes, it was good for Tottenham fans because it's very exciting to have AC Milan come to that lovely stadium that Spurs have, and Spurs fans can go to the San Siro, which is obviously lovely, and they're going to take it down, you know, and build a new one.
Might be the last, so one of the last opportunities. Yeah.
And also, like, AC Milan, for those younger listeners who don't don't even know, AC Milan were massive for many years. They were one of the biggest teams in the world.
They won the Champions League all the time. Second biggest European Cup winners of all time.
Oh, there we go. Yeah. You might forget.
You with the knowledge there.
I do know that. Yeah. I do know that.
But some of the great teams, I remember watching Ancelotti's AC Milan, probably the most famous for me, which would have all the big players in, like Kaká. Speaking of crows.
Kaká!
Yeah, segued nicely.
That should have been that the segue. That was the segue.
Yeah, well.
Yeah,
so we get a bit Spurs out of sorts. I'm sure we'll talk about them in a bit. Other Premier League clubs maybe we already have, depending on how this podcast
we'll
is edited,
we'll come to discuss their game over the weekend as well. Eintracht Frankfurt have picked up Napoli, which is an exciting fixture. And, you know, Napoli, if we have time today, we'll talk about their win over Atalanta as well over the weekend. Still steaming ahead at the top of Serie A, looking fine.
Yeah, I think so. They struggled a bit this weekend, actually.
Yeah.
But I think they will ease past Eintracht.
Sure. Okay, fine. Borussia Dortmund-Chelsea.
We haven't talked about Liverpool-Real Madrid, which I feel like is a big fixture.
I'm coming back to that to do at the end.
Okay.
But, you know, thanks for spoiling it. You know, you can trust me as a host. You know, I have been doing this for a long time.
No, I mean, I believe you. I was just
If you're not careful, Crow's going to come out. And we've heard about what Crow's done to other unmentioned members of this team previously. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
I had actually just completely missed that off the list. Liverpool, Real Madrid. What a big game.
Yeah. And Liverpool turning into Real Madrid in a lot of respects, I think.
How so?
Well, you
know, like Joe turns into Crow.
Yes. The segues today.
Yeah. Devastating consequences. But do go on.
I just mean in terms of like the fact that we've always talked about how Real Madrid can't control games.
Mm.
And they sort of rely on moments to get through games.
Magical moments.
Yeah. And I feel like Liverpool are turning into that a little bit now. Like their pressing isn't working so well. So we're going to talk about the game yesterday against Spurs. But that was a game where Liverpool got the goals in the first half and then just lost control in
Held
the second
on.
Half.
Yeah. In fact, when we talk about that, let's come back to discuss I suppose this game's so far in advance.
It's miles away. Because I say that Real Madrid looked like they were from a different planet when they played Celtic. It was like watching two different sports being played. It was the gulf is 5-1 doesn't do it justice.
Right.
It was two different sports.
Hot diggity. Okay. Yeah. Well, Borussia Dortmund Chelsea is another fixture. Well, I guess there's the Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang reunion tour. Maybe we can get Arsenal involved in it somehow, and it can be all the teams.
It's the Champions League. Arsenal aren't in the Champions League.
Oh, that's right. Yes, of course. Inter Milan Porto. We talked a little bit about Porto. Inter Milan struggling a little bit in Serie A this season, John. I suppose that's a bit of a difficult one to predict. That feels on the list. That feels like the most sort of classic round of 16 fixture, though, doesn't it? Milan, Porto, Inter Porto, yeah.
Yeah, Inter lost to Juventus yesterday, who we've been saying for...
I said Milan instead of Inter, and he looked at me funny. Mm. Yeah.
I can't remember what I just said. Inter.
Be good to have
Inter
some analysis on this podcast, though. I feel like we haven't had any.
This is going well.
Minutes. Yeah.
Inter lost to Juventus yesterday, who we've been talking about as being pretty poor this season.
Right.
And, Juventus have had a poor season, but are still well in contention for Champions League and Inter just sort of dropping away a little bit, which is kind of interesting. It'd be interesting to see how they just said the word interesting loads there.
It's interesting.
Interesting. That's why. But it's going to be fascinating to see. I used a different word. Fascinating to see how they sort of turn things around, because it feels like with Inzaghi, maybe things are getting a bit stale. So
yeah, okay. And the final game is PSG Bayern Munich, which is also a big banger. Feels like a big banger, JJ.
Yeah, John did a great video on PSG last week, I think, on Tifo IRL. So you want to learn all about PSG and whether they're really good enough to win the Champions League this year.
Have you seen our TikTok went viral?
Which one?
Our Messi one.
The one I did?
Yeah. Oh,
that's good.
It did...
I had a feeling that might happen.
200 and something thousand views over the week.
Is that right?
It's got 43,000 hearts on it. Is that a like on TikTok? A TikTok like?
You are looking at the wrong person here.
Yeah. I was kind of trying to look at Jamie, actually, but you were in his way, so, you know.
Does Jamie understand TikTok?
He's a young man. Yeah. Jamie says yes, and that's how we know it's true.
Yeah. Well, anyway, for more detailed information on PSG, John's done out in a video, so I'd watch that. But... I think we're probably going to end up at some point, maybe in the last game, talking about what PSG need to do to really win the Champions League, which is probably not have like five individual golden boys doing all the bits and pieces. But I will say, Messi is maybe back to his absolute best. His numbers are incredible, but just watching him is... We've seen that a thousand times. It's pure joy. It's so fun to watch Messi. Neymar's also playing really well right before the World Cup. And you've got Mbappe... They've changed the system a little bit, so Mbappe and Messi play either side of this front two with Neymar kind of in the 10, and they all rotate a lot. It's quite fun to watch, and the midfield's changed this season as well. Verratti and I know Fabian Ruiz plays mostly, does it? Or
yeah,
yeah, be, those names.
Yeah, they've been playing Fabian Ruiz and someone else who I can't remember. Who is it? Someone young, I feel.
Carlos Soler.
Vitinha.
Yeah, he's been playing well. Yeah, and then Bayern trying to transition a bit under Julian Nagelsmann, but you've got Choupo-Moting is suddenly now at 33, as good as Messi.
Yeah.
He scored in every one of his like last nine games or something crazy.
Wow.
Was it? That's
and,
too much, isn't it?
Lovely. Bayern Munich are finally top of the Bundesliga after a huge amount of time. So
well,
Union Berlin finally getting crushed
yes.
by Leverkusen yesterday.
I believe Seb Stafford was at that game, which is why he's not here today on the podcast. But I'm sure we'll hear more about that in the future. Before we move on from the Champions League entirely, you've mentioned Celtic already, JJ. I can tell you that in the group that Napoli were in, Rangers officially became the worst Champions League team in the group stages ever.
Yeah.
And they also lost to St Johnstone over the weekend in the Scottish Premiership as well. So a bit of a tough time of it for Rangers.
What you've done there is given me a really good opportunity to do something that many Aberdeen fans would like to do. But as a neutral journalist, I will say, well, it's a shame that they...
It's quite an interesting sentence, that what you just said.
Yeah. I mean, obviously... Yeah.
Carry on, though.
On one hand, it is funny. On another hand...
It's also funny.
Yeah. Celtic and Rangers just looked so, so out of it. And like having been giants in European football before, like genuinely they were. I mean, Rangers were in Europa League final last season. I don't know, like, it's compared to like Victoria Pilsen, just a team you just don't really think about. With all respect of it, you know, the history of that club and all the fans who support them, they're just basically like that now. Just no chance whatsoever in that Champions League. Europa League's better off. Helps the coefficient as well. Just go for that, lads. Just do that.
Well, I feel duty bound to say that Celtic were much better in the Champions League this time around than Rangers.
No, they definitely were. To be clear, they were. Rangers, they're having a bad time just now. Like, you are correct.
Can I just make the point that John is just obsessed with Ange Postecoglou? That's why.
He's brilliant, Postecoglou. He'll be in Premier League soon. Lots of Rangers fans are very unhappy with Giovan Bronckhorst. But then these things tend to happen with managers when you get a few bad results and they lose a bit of shape and whatever. Then results start to go against you. You shouldn't lose to St Johnstone ever, but it just seems like I think a lot of teams are just shut down now towards the World Cup.
Yeah.
Maybe Rangers are doing that sort of thing where it's almost over. Although weirdly, I told you this the other day, Aberdeen play Celtic on the day before the World Cup final.
Right.
That league starts again then.
Yeah. I guess it can.
This year's weird.
Well, anyway, let's talk about the Europa League before we go to a break. You've mentioned it there. It's about to get very, very difficult, and I'll explain why, because there's a list of seeded teams here that include teams such as Manchester United, Michelin, Monaco, Nantes, PSV Eindhoven, Rennes, Roma, and Union Berlin, right? Those are the seeded teams. The unseeded teams that I'm assuming, I'm inferring from this plan, means that they'll be facing the seeded teams in the round of 16, include Ajax, Barcelona, Juventus, Leverkusen, Salzburg, Sevilla, Shakhtar Donetsk, and Sporting, right? Which is tough. The Europa League first knockout stage, there's going to be some tasty games, John.
Yeah, I feel like there's been a bit of a weird like upheaval in the Champions League in terms of teams going through that we might not have expected to and teams not going through who you might have expected to. And that's meant that the standard of the Europa League now is incredibly high. It's more fun, isn't it? It's just more fun knowing that you're going to see matchups that you haven't seen before or for a very long time, whereas like Bayern PSG, okay, it'll be a fun game, but like no one's intrigued as to the narrative of that. It's sort of the Champions League has become which of the super giants is going to win this time through.
I feel quite underwhelmed by this Champions League draw. I'm a bit more excited about what happens to like who Barcelona play and who Man United play for some reason. I'm not sure why that is.
Yeah, like, I'm a Freiburg fan and they got through to the Europa League and they've done really well. They topped their group and they've played teams that you just wouldn't ever expect them to play, and they have the chance now of playing some really big teams in Europe, and that for me is way more compelling a competition than just being like, okay, like are Man City gonna Man City their way out of the Champions League as they always do every season. It's and I suppose this is the big question about the European Super League, right? Is that how much do people care about the same big teams playing against each other? To what extent is rarity like
better? I mean, I compare it to when you play like FIFA or something like that, because you always do go as the big teams against each other. But it's actually more fun when you go the randoms, when you push a random square and get random teams against each other. That's when it becomes more fun against your pals. I don't know. The Super League would probably work not in the format that was, put together in the first place, because the big teams are the ones that everyone does watch. And as we said, the Premier League slowly might end up becoming like another one of these European leagues, which is just dominated by the ones with the most money, which will happen over time stealthily. So in Football Manager, interestingly, apparently after about 2 years, the format changes to just being a big league.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. That's interesting.
Yeah. They also predicted that the Qatar World Cup would be taken away from it, which didn't happen.
They have variants, don't they, in Football Manager? Like, some timelines are different.
Different realities, different dimensions, yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Because time isn't linear.
Speaking of time not being linear, they are actually doing the Europa League right now. So by the time you listen to this, we will probably know what the... we'll definitely know what the games are. But we don't know as we're saying it, yeah? So if you want to leave a comment or get angry, feel free. But just bear in mind, we don't know.
By the time that you listen to it, we will know. So again, time
we will know then.
Because then we don't know, but yeah. Now we also don't.
Anyway, one thing I'd love to say, we talked about Shakhtar Donetsk already. The Athletic have made an incredible podcast miniseries, having spent some time with them. Is that's right, Steve. There's 3 episodes out now, isn't there?
Yeah, as you'll listen to it on Tuesday, there are 3 episodes that you can go and listen to immediately, and more are coming. So they're basically Adam Crafton and Joey Durso from The Athletic have, over the sort of past few weeks and months, been in contact and speaking to players and non-playing staff at Shakhtar Donetsk. Now, Shakhtar Donetsk, from the eastern region of Ukraine originally, a good few years ago now, famous for Brazilian players such as Willian and others coming through there. Fernandinho, of course, ex-Man City player. Shakhtar haven't played at the Donbass Arena since 2014 due to the beginnings of what would then, obviously, as we now know, become the full-scale invasion of Ukraine by Russia. So they've been sort of homeless, in a manner of speaking, since 2014. In that time, they've managed to remain competitive, so much so that they were in this year's Champions League. Obviously, by now we'll know who they will be playing in the Europa League, because they finished third, very narrowly as well. But this series, Adam and Joey speak to the captain, Shakhtar's director of football, Dario Cerna, now, who of course played for them as well. It's an incredible story, really, in terms of what they've been able to achieve in the context of remaining competitive at this level, when you consider all of the turmoil and the hardship that all Ukrainians are going through at this moment in time. You can find it on the Athletic app, or if you search Away From Home in whichever podcast feed you use. And we're going to play a little teaser at the end of this podcast as well.
Oh, lovely. Okay, fine. Well, that's good. Adam Crafton and Joey Durso, both friends of the podcast as well. So let's all go and I can't wait to listen to that. I'm going to look forward to it, and let's all go and support that. Thank you, Steve Hanke. Okay, let's take a break now. And when we come back, we will discuss some football.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Okay, let's begin the second half with Chelsea 0-1 Arsenal, JJ. This was a big game, and a big team won.
Yeah, I thought Arsenal were brilliant in this game. I think it was everything. You know, when you talk about players who say the manager sees every single thing that could possibly happen in the game and they were prepared, I think Arsenal were ready for everything in this match. And it's weird because Graham Potter's obviously got his team in transition. They're trying to learn how he wants to play under them, which is not hugely dissimilar to what Tuchel was doing. It's not exactly the same, but it's not a world way. And they were doing clever things like having... What you saw basically throughout this game is that Chelsea's midfield kept being emptied. They were playing a 4-2-3-1, but it was lopsided. They focused on the right-hand side. And I think that was because they were scared of Martinelli getting in behind them. So they're trying to stop him at source down that left side. And they had a couple of bits going on, basically, that were... I've done it in a video on Tifo IRL, where it's far more in-depth than what I'm struggling to say here. But Arsenal were doubling up in the wide areas. They were creating space for themselves. They had a game plan. So they started off playing in a certain way and finished in a certain way. At the end, they weren't dropping deep. They were pushing up. They're pushing tighter up, squishing Chelsea in so they couldn't get out. And what you saw was there was no dialogue between the front players of Chelsea and the defence. And then they didn't have a midfield because they were being dragged out wide. So Arsenal were managing to do this thing that was vacating the middle so they could then play out wide with an overload and preventing Chelsea from playing out because Aubameyang wasn't dropping in to do what he's supposed to do. He wasn't going left enough to try and help out in the wide area. Because then what you had, that lopsided 4-3-3-1. What I mean by that is Raheem Sterling was a right winger and then Kai Havertz was the 10, but really he was the right side. So he was in the half space almost next to the winger. And then Mason Mount was playing as a 10. So there's no left-sided player, which should have been filled up by Kukurea on that side and probably Aubameyang swapping and rotating with Mount. So it seems like a little bit of... Well, it's a lack of cohesion probably with the players and understanding the roles, and they don't have the partnerships just yet to make that work. And so Saka was keeping Kukurea pinned back, which meant they lost.
A very interesting battle, those two players, isn't there?
Yeah, and I think if you play Cesar Azpilicueta as your right back, I think the hope might be that Kukurea is essentially a wing back, not a full back, so then they can turn into the three. The back four becomes a three. Two central centre backs, start to cover more of the pitch, and Azpilicueta tucks in, because then Sterling's your wide right and Kukurea is your wide left, because he can do that. But you can also change it on the other side. The theory behind the tactics of it makes sense, but it just didn't work. And I think it's because of what Arsenal did. And had Gabriel Jesus been a little bit taller, he would have scored a diving header. They created two big chances. I think there was one that Partey took off the head of Martinelli or someone like that in the box. I can't remember who did it. The ball came in the box and Partey took it when he should have just left it for the header at the back post. Probably would have been another goal. It's only 1-0, but I think they really had this dominated. And I wonder what Chelsea fans would thought of what their team looks like just now, because that's the first time they've lost two games in a row before Tuchel. Tuchel never really had that. And I think, whereas we know Potter's a great tactical manager, and he's clearly he's very normal. This is the thing I'm trying to say. Potter's a very normal person. Tuchel is not. And so what you see...
Barcelona have got Man United in the...
I told you! I said they would get them! Oh, I'm so excited about that.
That's the Europa League Barcelona Manchester United draw.
Oh my god!
Very interesting.
This is like the 90s. Yeah. Embedded into
two aging giants clashing out. It's like when
Pedri versus McTominay. I love it.
When Rocky and Apollo came back to fight each other in their 60s or whatever. Did that happen? I don't know. Anyway, we will talk about Chelsea. I want to stay on Arsenal though for a moment, John, because you tweeted over the weekend that the Chelsea Arsenal game, very good example of Arsenal's narrow rest defence, and then you slung some heat at the Sky pundits. You said they were bad people.
Yeah, there wasn't even
they're
Sky,
wrong, and
BT.
You hate them. And it was BT. Yes. And you said everyone that isn't you is a bad person and doesn't know what they're talking about. What did you mean by all of that?
Well, when I said everyone is bad, I meant you, actually. That was just
me.
For you.
And it's very interesting to hear from your internal perspective that I represent everyone to you.
You
very
are everything to me, and everything is bad.
But what about Arsenal's narrow rest defence? It sounds like a bird, doesn't it? A small bird. The narrow rest defence, Like you'd find it in an ornithological museum. Oh, look, Daddy. There's a narrow rest defence over there. What about them, though?
Bird-themed this episode.
Yeah, very bird-themed.
Yeah, rest defence. It's interesting hearing JJ talking about the thing that Arsenal did really well in the second half was like squeezing Chelsea high up the pitch. Because I think my criticism of Arsenal... I guess in the first half of the season so far, has been that they go ahead in games really well and then they struggle to control games later on. And I think part of that is to do with the fact that they're not brave enough to push teams deeper. And so what they do is they try to possess the ball, and it's easier to possess the ball deeper in your structure. So it's easier to play it around your defence, etc. But also if you lose the ball in that situation, it's much easier for the opposition to score and cause you problems. Whereas if you do what Manchester City do, which is control the game start to finish and they push right up and they keep oppositions pinned in, Not only is it easier counterintuitively for you to control the ball, but also if you lose the ball, it's a lot harder for opponents to get back towards you. And so a lot of that is to do with the fact that Arsenal were committing players forward. And to do that, you have to have what we call a rest defence. Now, rest defence is like a cool, trendy word in tactical circles. And
trendy.
This fucking guy. Are you done? Yeah? I hate everyone.
Yeah, I'm done. Thanks.
But yeah, to commit players forward, you have to be really clear about what your structure is in possession so that if you lose the ball, you can then defend. So that's what rest defense is. Like, it comes from a German phrase, Restverteidigung.
As all the cool kids' trendy words do.
I was going to try and make up a word for it that sounded German, and it would have sounded like that.
Hey, you know when everyone started to say wicked? That comes from the German word Verkeider, doesn't it? Which means to be cool, right. Of course. Now, please continue.
Or evil.
But yeah, people think rest defense means like relaxing, right? Rest. When an English person says rest, usually we sort of mean like chilling out, right? But actually the German phrase, I think, refers more to like everything that's left over. So the rest defense is like, okay, we're all attacking.
The remainder
What are the rest of the team doing? Yeah. How are they defending?
Right.
So Arsenal do this set up in possession where they have the two centre-backs and then they have the two full-backs usually inverting, so getting quite close in the middle and around the pivot player. So you have like five players in rest defence, but you get quite narrow. It allows you to build up quite nicely because you've got a lot of players in the same area. But also they seed space in the wide areas because the idea is that, okay, it will be easy for the opposition to get a player into that wide area and take it down and attack you. But for the ball, if the ball is going to go there and then the player has to get towards the goal, it's a lot further distance to travel than the unit who's defending.
And so, there's all players in the middle.
Yeah. And so Chelsea were set up to try and make the most of this against Arsenal. So they played Raheem Sterling as a wide player and he was basically touchline hugging and he was an out ball. So you can see there's a couple of chances they created in the first half where Kai Havertz ends up in basically the same situation. And that comes from, firstly, Mendy playing the ball into that channel. And then there was another one where Arsenal, I think Gabriel lost the ball and then Chelsea attacked really quickly in that channel as well. And in both instances, you can see the way that Arsenal defend. It's like very structured. They do the same thing every time. So I did a thread on Twitter just showing what that is. But the important thing to take away from that is that because Arsenal are able to defend with fewer players because they have a very specific structure in possession, then it means you can commit for more players forward, which means you can then control the ball in more advanced areas.
And was your point to suggest that whilst perhaps at halftime pundits were concerned that Arsenal were giving up so much space in the wide areas, you would concur with what JJ said at the beginning, which is that they predicted everything and they didn't mind giving that space
up. A gamble. So you know that you're giving up that wide area. And what I was trying to show with my thread is that despite the fact that Chelsea were trying to exploit that, which is something that Arsenal are giving up, actually Arsenal defended both of those moments really well and stopped them from generating more dangerous chances.
I think they also were able to switch slightly, switch systems slightly within the compared to blah, 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 blah. They were trying to react to what Chelsea were doing. So if the normal build-up shape would be a 2-3 with the fullbacks being inverted around the central pivot. In this game, what they were doing was they were playing a 3-2. So they changed it. So Zinchenko was getting very close to Partey and basically playing as another midfielder, he becoming the deep lying playmaker next to Partey, also doing the same sort of thing from that deep position. And what I like, I mean, it's becoming more common now, is that teams, rather than having the fullback being the widest player hugging the touchline, it's the wingers, which makes total sense because the wingers are the most dangerous attacking players you can get in those positions. So if you get Saka or Martinelli 1v1 with a fullback, that's much better than having a fullback who's already run all the way up there, then taking them on. And you think like Liverpool's attacking menace came a lot from their fullbacks when they were at their absolute best, and now they're trying to revert to not having that quite so much because it's not the done thing anymore. It's almost like the trend has changed, or it's that cycle's over. And Guardiola's been doing this. He was doing it at Bayern Munich a lot earlier with the inverted fullbacks, so you can manage the counterattack. It's not just for build up. It's like John's saying as well. It's to manage the counterattack. So when you're higher up the pitch with that shape, suddenly you've got, rather than having two centre-backs of one pivot player and two wide full-backs in position which leave space in those particular areas, you're sort of hedging your bets and keeping players in the middle of the pitch. So even though you're not directly next to someone, you're blocking space someone could use. So it makes them think differently about how they get the out ball.
Right.
And you saw it against Chelsea where they couldn't get it into Aubameyang and Havertz because they were well managed.
Yeah. Well, they managed to win the game 1-0. It potentially could have been more. There was a fantastic chance or a good opportunity in the first half that Gabriel Jesus had, John. He missed it. It was a headed opportunity. I think if he'd got a head on it, it probably would have gone in, or at least to say the XG for that individual chance probably would have been fairly high.
He did get a touch on it, so it should, I think, be registered as an expected. Let me have a look.
Well, a lovely small detail. But that kind of led the commentators at the time to talk about how Gabriel Jesus probably underperforms as a goal scorer, which I think is fair. But I was struck during the game that I feel like that conversation, because it's the kind of one fact known about him, it's the one detraction, because he's so good everywhere else, and in comparison to the rest of his ability on a pitch, it does stand out as the negative, that people just kind of say it all the time, even in situations when it's not necessarily appropriate. In terms of Gabriel Jesus' contribution to Arsenal since he's joined the summer, it's like hard to argue anything other than very, very, very important. But in terms of his goal-scoring record specifically, he does underperform.
Yeah, largely. I think there's been maybe one season in the last five where he's overperformed his expected goals.
What do you mean by that?
In terms of explain expected goals.
Yeah, what do you mean by the fact that one in the last five seasons he's overperformed?
Yeah, so obviously every time a player takes a shot, then the stats nerds can generate a probability for that shot to be scored. And that is simply based on a number of different variables. It depends on the model. But what they do is they take thousands and thousands of chances from historical data. They assess, you know, whether or not that goal was scored in that situation. And what you're then trying to do is build a model which can look at a number of variables. So the most important one is shot positioning, right? If you're in front of the goal, you're more likely to score than if you're to the side of the goal, or if you're close to the goal, you're more likely to score than if it's a long way away. There are other variables that are taken into account. So StatsBomb, I know they take like the ball height into account. So if the ball's off the floor, they'll measure how high it is. They'll take into account things like defensive positioning, where the goalkeeper is positioned, etc. And the idea then is that you take all of these data points and you can be fairly confident that, you know, in general, that shot that you've taken would be scored in a certain percentage of time. But what you can do is you can then aggregate all of those chances that Gabriel Jesus had, add them all up and say, you know, the average player would expect them to score more. So for example, I think one season he scored 12 goals from about 14 expected goals. So
Right. You
would say that the average player, you would expect to get 14 goals with those sorts of chances.
And is that a big difference? So for example, we can see in the 2021 season, I think he underperformed quite heavily there.
I think it's about five goals is his worst.
What would be considered a big difference? So for example, if it is 14 goals or 12 goals, like, is it a goal or two off, or is it? I mean, five sounds
five
big
is,
in that
five
scenario.
Is big, yeah. But the thing is, because it's based on averages, you will get, you know, that's like anyone who takes that shot. So that could potentially be a defender, whatever. Like,
yeah,
you would expect them to be worse at finishing. Now
they're still playing high level, so it is
yeah,
all that
yeah,
level
exactly.
As well.
So
but you'd expect a striker to overperform.
You would expect a player who you consider to be a good finisher to overperform.
Right.
Now the thing that it's important to note is that, actually, the biggest skill often for strikers is getting into the right place to generate good chances. So the fact that Gabriel Jesus is able to generate the amounts of expected goals that he gets is a good sign. The fact that he slightly underperforms historically just suggests he may be not quite so good as a good finisher. But, you know, someone like Messi will historically overperform his expected goals. We should probably look at the numbers for that.
Last season he's underperforming. So people say he didn't play very well last season. He got six goals in the league, but his XG was about 11.3. I think I'm right. I did it in the video. So that's a massive underperformance from Messi, especially. Obviously, quite high numbers for amount of games he played in the new club and all the circumstances that Messi had. But he was hitting the post a lot or just missing shots. It just wasn't quite happening for him, which is why he underperformed. Whereas players like Harry Kane always score over their XG. It's one of the big reasons that Spurs have done so well in recent seasons is that him and Son have overperformed their XG constantly. So Spurs have always been overperforming. And when those players aren't totally on form, that's when they drop down to being below Champions League level. It's what they've really had. Liverpool, the season they won the league, over their XG. Jesus, I mean, if you look at...
It was pretty massive, wasn't it, that overperformance, the Liverpool season?
For goals scored, yeah, and especially towards the end of the season as well. Again, I covered that in a video on T4IRL if you want to have a look at what's actually happened to Liverpool, it's called. Now, with Jesus, the most goals he's ever scored in a season, in a league season, is 14 goals in 1920 for Man City. It's the most he's scored. And I think he played through the middle an awful lot that season. And for Man City, you're going to score loads. Raheem Sterling scores loads for Man City because he gets lots of chances in high-value areas. But apart from that, he's never really, he's generally played in the wide areas because he's better suited to being Guardiola's called him the best defensive presser. I can't remember what the exact phrase was, but the best pressing forward in the world because he's able to track players. Against Real Madrid in the Champions League once, he played wide left. It was also a wing back, also a forward. He does all the work you need of him and then is very, very clever in the final third, especially to rotate positions with players, to drag people out of position and get himself into position. And that's why his XG tends to be higher than lots of players who play wide because he does get in the right positions. But his finishing still, when he underperforms it so often, you think he just can't rely on him to score 25 goals a season, 20 goals a season. He'll get you about 14, like a really good inside forward, which is probably what he is. But you want to play him through the middle because he can also lead that press and do certain things that other players can't. I mean, maybe the same as like Bobby Firmino, who can play through the middle as a central forward, but you don't think of him as a striker because he's not. He's better suited to be a bit deeper, and he sometimes goes into wide areas as well. And Jesus is maybe similar. And I think Arsenal going into the window, they said that they'd like to be able to invest because they want to take advantage of this huge position they're in. And I think they look at someone who can do the defensive work, but also give them something in front of goal that can get them just the extra bit that they lack. Because Nketiah, I think, seems to lack that as well. The real clinical nature that you need to finish it. And you look at what, I mean, Liverpool identified a need to have a striker who scored goals. They got Nunez in, mm-hmm. and City obviously got Haaland, which is a different kind of style of player to what they've got, but it gives you.
They want themselves something. A Robin van Persie.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. There's loads of players. I mean, that boy at Benfica we talked about earlier, Gonçalo Ramos, might be a half decent effort. And then you've got Benjamin Sesko, but he's going to Leipzig, isn't he?
Yeah, he's already signed. Yeah.
Okay. Well, listen, before we go to the break now, we do have the Europa League fixes in, so I'll just run through them very quickly. Barca, Man United, as we discussed before.
It's maybe worth noting that this is the knockout stages to get into the round of 16. So
these are the
teams who dropped out of the Champions League playing against the second place teams.
Right, so there's more to come.
Yeah, so these games will be played and then it will go to the round of 16.
Fine. Okay, so Barca, Man United, we've got Juve, Nantes, Sporting versus Michelin. Shakhtar have drawn Stade Rennes. Stade Rennes? How do you say Rennes?
Rennes.
Yeah, it's the role, isn't it? The Stade Rennes, for anyone who doesn't know that. Ajax, Union Berlin. That's quite an exciting game, isn't it? Leverkusen, Monaco, Sevilla, PSV, and Salzburg, Roma, where there is no rolled R. Anyway, let's go to a break, and when we come back, we'll discuss some more football.
Hi, I'm Adam Crafton, and I'm the host of The Athletic's new documentary series, Away From Home. We've been following Ukrainian football team Shakhtar Donetsk through the Champions League group stage. They've had to play their home games in Poland following Russia's invasion of Ukraine.
The first bomb, you'll never forget.
In this series, we're going to take you inside Shakhtar. Travelling with them across Europe as they set out on their Champions League odyssey.
It's not only about football now, it's about the show that we are fighting.
Are we speaking to those in Ukraine itself, hearing stories about how the war has affected them?
My wife's father, he died.
They killed him.
Subscribe now to Away From Home to follow the whole story.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Ah, yes. We have a couple of things to sort of crack on with here. Tottenham Hotspur 1-2 Liverpool. JJ, Liverpool, good first half, scored two goals, and then spent much of the rest of the time sort of clinging on to the edge of a cliff by their fingernails.
They look knackered.
Yeah.
Liverpool look look so tired. They've had loads of injury problems, as we know. Klopp, and I think Robertson said in their post-match that they were talking about how they knew that they'd get chances to score in the first half because Spurs start slowly, but that Spurs would create far more in the second half and be much better. And this really was a game of two halves, and I think Liverpool started really well, had control of it. They're playing the variation on the 4-3-3, which is more of a 4-diamond-2 with Salah and Nunez, the two strikers, in possession and Firmino dropping to make the diamond. But out of possession, they put Firmino next to Salah to the middle because he's much, much better at defending from the front and showing the ball where it's supposed to go. And I think they played well. I think Kanate is, he's probably not underrated. He's probably rated, but he's brilliant. He's a really good player. We saw the best and some of the worst of, maybe not the worst, it's really harsh, and Alexander Arnold. Like, again, the caveat always that, like, obviously, like, watching Alexander Arnold, he's a great player. The best and some of the less best. Yeah, some of the less best. So, like, he's hitting these first time passes that are going 60, 70 yards across the pitch to open up the play. They're amazing. His delivery is phenomenal. Like, technique, all of it's fine. And then just can get beaten with the physical side of defending, getting beaten for pace, beaten for strength, balance. Looks frustrated quite a lot on the pitch sometimes. Cause
it's very rhythmic what you just said there, wasn't it? Beating for pace, beating for strength, balance, beating
I'm
for strength.
I'm in a flow state. So I think he looks a bit frustrated.
Try and rhyme the rest of it. Try and do the rest of it in a sort of spoken word thing.
I'm JJ and I'm here to say Alexander Arnold is a good player at the end of the day. He may lose some of his defensive duels, but when he plays on top,
he's the crown jewels.
He rules. Oh, he rules. Leave me alone. And then
Jules was a bold word to go with for a rhyme there.
The problem with Spurs in this game is they have problems from previous matches that are the same. They start slow in the first half, and in the second, they come to the match and they get the...
That's good. Okay. Make sure, try to rhyme something with Kulusevski.
Okay, hang on. Emerson Royal needs to put some more pressure...
Yeah.
Because when the left winger gets down near to him, Spurs become in danger.
Yeah.
Half rhyme.
That works.
But the game really changed when they took on Kulusevski.
Likes to say he really relies on Dejan Kulusevski.
Oh,
he's coming in. I wanted to have the Kulusevski
to be fair. You take it. If you're sitting in the background, very easy to rhyme. Yeah. You know? So
anyway, so like
backseat rhymer.
Yeah, backseat rhymer.
Just to like to chop that one off, Kulusevski was immediately made them much, much better when he came on the pitch.
This isn't rhyming.
No, I'm out of that now.
Oh, you're finished.
Yeah,
that bit's done.
Because Spurs had to play Perisic as a forward next to Kane because they've got injury problems just like Liverpool do. They're really short of the firepower that makes them as good as they should be. Certain players aren't performing as well as they want them to be. And the like, defence especially, you can see Eric Dier made that horrible mistake passing back with his head. He could see Salah as well in his peripheral. Like, I don't know why he makes his decision still. As soon as he starts to look like quite a capable, confident defender, he does something like that. And it's such a weird player. Like, he'll always be just below. He's such a talented player out there, but he always has that in him. That little,
sometimes, you know, people just do stupid things.
I guess, yeah.
I
do all the time, yeah. I mean, I just don't have to do it on the football pitch with one of the best strikers of all time next to me. Yeah.
Apart from when we played five-a-side last week.
Oh, who was there, John? Did a different player come that was one of the best players of all time? Anyway, we need to sort of wrap this up because we're really dragging today. The podcast gets longer and longer every week. Is there anything else, John, that you would like to say about Liverpool or Spurs before we move on? And by say, I mean meow, brief. No, there's nothing. Perfect. Okay. Aston Villa 3-1 Manchester United. Big game, John. Unai Emery coming in with the heat. I mean, it wasn't that hot, but it was a fantastic result.
Yeah, really good and interesting to see what the impact of a good coach can have in a very short space of time.
I don't want to blow that bald head of yours up too much for fear that it explodes and the skin goes everywhere. But you did sort of predict the formation, the state of play for Aston Villa, and you weren't far off.
I wasn't far off, but I also was far off. So let's be honest about that. But
okay.
Yeah, we saw the 4-4-2 that we expect of...
Schrodinger's tactician over here.
If you look at the formation,
yeah,
that's a science joke, which...
Sure.
Yeah.
Really landed.
There's
played a 4-4-2.
There's someone out there, I believe this.
Yeah, aliens, exactly. We all believe in aliens. They played a 4-4-2.
Yes.
But it was a bit lopsided.
Yeah, so... His 4-4-2 at Villarreal was quite lopsided as well, and it was designed around getting one of your fullbacks quite far forward and then having all of these safety nets to stop that becoming a problem defensively. So they would sit in a 4-4-2 mid-block, usually in the defensive phase, but then they would... He used midfielders who were you wouldn't necessarily expect to see in a wide berth in the midfield line. So he used Francis Coquelin for a while as a sort of left winger. But actually the idea was that Coquelin would drift inside, create space for the fullback to then move into, and then you end up looking a lot closer to like a 3-5-2, and then you would have like a more attacking player on the other side of that midfield, and they would like often go in behind the strikers. You'd have maybe one of the strikers dropping in to help out, and so the structure changed a lot. But there was all of these safety nets to make sure that, so for example, on the right, the midfielder would push forward, but then you'd have Juan Foyt, who is more of a defensive fullback on that side, so that would cover any sort of frailties that opened up. And we saw similar things happening with Villa. I think I suspect it was maybe a little bit more two-sided, so it felt as though at times it looked like Villa were playing almost like a 4-2-2, so their wide players were drifting inside, so they had Jacob Ramsey on one side and then Buendia on the other. But I think it was similar to the Villarreal approach but flipped. So rather than the left-sided midfielder drifting inside and allowing the left back to get forward, it was Jacob Ramsey who was drifting inside and allowing the right back to get forward. But a little bit of that was happening on the other side as well, because Luca Digne is obviously a fairly aggressive fullback as well. Mm-hmm. So it just gave them the opportunity for both of their midfielders to sort of come inside, generate space for the fullbacks to get into as well. And then we saw Leon Bailey playing as a centre forward with Ollie Watkins, who I think is maybe the most perfect Unai Emery player, playing the, sorry, I just swallowed my tongue, the Arno Danjuma role, quite nicely there as well.
Yeah.
And yeah, just look, really interesting things in terms of, so at Villarreal we saw a more creative passer with a more defensive player in the midfield too.
Yeah.
And we saw the same thing happening, but like Leander Dendonca as maybe the more defensive player who can ball carry, and then Douglas Luiz being used as a player who they're going to generate space around so he can get the ball and help them transition forward. So yeah, lots of similarities between the Villarreal side, but also kind of interesting different tweaks, because he's obviously got a different squad, different players can play different roles. So yes, it's sort of what I said in the video, like it will be something like this structure, but he will find different roles for different players, because that's how players work.
Well, we look forward to seeing more from Aston Villa. JJ, Manchester United without Bruno Fernandes looked a little bit dry.
Just putting loads of crosses in. They get no creativity through the middle.
Yeah.
Even with Christian Eriksen there.
Ten Hag actually said after the game, didn't he, that he was a bit disappointed with how quick they were to put a cross in. I think he was making the point that it wasn't him asking them to do that.
Oh, hang on, Carl Anker texted me and he said something funny about it.
What other things I will say about Manchester United? Ten Hag
called the amount of crosses United attempted as stupid.
Right, yes.
This is the thing, like, so a lot of things that Man United do in games are not what I think they've been coached to do.
Yeah.
And that's been a big problem for several years.
Yes, it has.
And Ten Hag's clearly getting a bit annoyed with it now and again, but he's like quietly annoyed. I think he's probably furious behind closed doors with him.
We haven't got very long, so can I ask you, I think, the most important question as it currently stands with this Manchester United team, right? Can you expect to win a game when you start in a Premier League match against a team like Aston Villa, who've got their new manager bounce and have got all decent players and whatever? I know they've got injuries. When they start with a 38-year-old forward who cannot do the main thing that the team needs to do in order to win. We hear from John and you all the time that pressing is a team game, and I'm not saying that Ronaldo can't press at all, but being defensively positionally aware was just never been part of his game, and is not what he contributed at other clubs previously either, right? So the expectation that a 38-year-old version of Ronaldo would be able to do that and fill in for Rashford or Anthony Martial in that role, who are both pretty adept in that area, I mean, it just seems like a stupid idea. I know they don't have anybody else, it's a bad idea, right? And doesn't it all the many of the problems start there?
How do you create chances for him? If he's not making runs, he wants to play in his little other space. He's mostly in the middle, trying to get into space to feed off the scraps of things, but they're not getting them. So all the chances are going wide from the fullbacks, just lobbing the ball into the box, which is not ideal because the teams sit back against them. They can't create. They can create in transition, which is when Bruno Fernandes is very good. And although they missed him in this game, they actually probably, I was thinking about it, having done a video on it, I think actually they probably have the same problems, because Fernandes has the same problems in the middle, but he's not Ozil the way he creates chances. He just gets the ball and sort of makes it happen. And
it's
Ronaldo,
Eriksen really on their team who has got the expertise in breaking down their blocks, right?
Yeah, but even that, I mean, it's still, he has to cross the ball into the box if they're starting to get someone deep, and if you don't play with intensity and speed and energy, then you lose that, and Man United don't really have that at the moment, and they're playing, Rashford as an outside winger in this game, and Garnacho's, he'll be decent, I think, but he's not quite there yet.
Sure.
And Ronaldo is like an elite Grant Holt.
Put it this way, right? If they didn't have Ronaldo, and let's forget that it was Ronaldo,
yeah,
would Manchester United ever seek to buy a player of that profile and age to play in their system? No, the answer is no.
No, right? I mean, the closest I can think of as an example would be Barca signing Lewandowski for the amount of money they did, but he's still in his prime. Like, he won the Ballon d'Or a couple of years
ago. And also, he suits their system, right?
I think Ronaldo might just also be having a bad season. And like, there's loads to it. I can't. I'm joking about the Grant Holt thing. Now, that's a joke.
Yeah, of course.
But like, he's one of the best players of all time. He is.
Grant Holt was very good.
Yeah.
Yeah, almost the elite Grant Holt is an oxymoron. Surely, Grant Holt was the elite.
He was
Grant
elite. Yes.
The elite. I'm just saying that to be funny. To be clear, everyone who's going to slag me off for this.
Yeah.
It's against that low block. It's hard. I don't think you could put Ronaldo in like that Liverpool team, who would struggle with breaking down that same sort of team and expect him to score. But equally, if they played with intensity and energy like they're supposed to, you might have got more crosses in the box, which would then give him the second ball to be able to score from.
Maybe.
It's a bunch of things that are not coming right at the same time. Man United are clearly in transition. It's going to take two years before they're anywhere near challenging for stuff.
Mm.
But they are getting better under Ten Hag. I think John covered it in a video recently. It's really good.
What do you think, just briefly, about the Ronaldo situation?
Yeah, I think that
insofar as it is a situation,
there's two issues. One is that the off-ball stuff isn't as good, and when you're one of the biggest jumps that we've seen from Manchester United has been under Ten Hag has been their ability to control games out of possession, and when you're doing high intense and high territorial pressing, you're only as good as your weakest link. Because as soon as one person isn't good enough, then there's a weakness that the opposition can then use to try and get around. So that's one thing. Mm-hmm. But the other thing is, like, even in you could put up with that if his on-ball stuff was good enough. Yeah. And I don't think at the moment he's doing enough to justify the detriment he has on the team's pressing in terms of his in-possession stuff. So, it's just a natural thing that happens. Players decline. Like, Cristiano Ronaldo is, what, 36, 37?
38.
38?
Yeah.
He's older than me. And look at me. If you need an example of something that has declined.
He's 37.
He's 37?
Yeah.
Why do I think he's 38?
He's 38 in February.
Oh, okay. By the time this podcast comes out, or by the time many of the games we've discussed in this podcast are played.
Well, again, in reference to time not being linear, maybe you listen to this in March, you will then be 38.
Maybe I did.
This will exist.
Yeah.
Until then.
Let's not release the podcast until March.
Yeah.
Then you'll be right.
Perfect. Let's do that.
But also release it today.
Yes. Yeah, you've been watching Interstellar again, haven't you?
No, I've been not.
Christopher Nolan's been trying to convince you of some sci-fi.
I'll tell you what he has
theories.
Been listening to, which questions the nature of time. It is my TIFO Talks.
That's right, episode. John. I was just about to ask you. Well, firstly, I was going to say that don't clap him,
yes,
Steve
clap
Hankles.
Me, Hankles.
I saw you highlight that, and I ignored you because I hate you. Now, TIFO Talks, you did an episode. The episode that came out last week was with Jamie Hamilton. Lovely Scottish accent. A really nice Scottish accent that I enjoyed listening to. And
No,
at all. Don't worry, JJ.
Don't worry,
you
JJ.
Don't need to listen.
Oh, no, fine.
He's done that thing where he goes, "Oh, I don't need to listen anymore. I can turn off."
I don't know, like it's the tube thing where I missed the tube stop. I don't know what happened. I don't know what happened there.
I was paying you a compliment.
Oh, sorry.
I wasn't. I was making fun of you. Jamie Hamilton, a UEFA A licensed coach guy, badge, got one of those badges. You know,
Holder.
I found out in the past that JJ told me those. They're not even real badges. What?
You wanted like one of those things you
so unlike, you know, when you would go to Brownies or something. It's a card.
It's like a driving license card.
Yeah, well, I've got a card, haven't I? Anyway, listen, that was a fantastic episode. If people haven't listened to that, Jamie Hamilton was very, I really enjoy. You listened to that one?
I said it on Twitter. I think it's one of the most interesting football conversations I've ever listened to.
Yeah, it is good, isn't it?
Yeah.
Listen, if you subscribe to this feed, if you're listening to this, it'll dropped into your phone there. If you're watching this on the YouTubes, that one's not a video. Head over to subscribe to the TIFO Football RSS feed on whatever your podcast audio listening platform of choice is. But John, who's coming up this coming Thursday?
We've got Dan Pelchin on.
Dan Pelchin.
Who has done a podcast with us before.
A return visitor.
Yeah, and we're talking about data analysis. And
and all the new trendy things.
I can't believe you, of all people, is upbraiding me on the use of the word trendy.
I mean, why disgusting. Would you say that? I'm extremely trendy. Very trendy guy. Anyway, if you want to listen to in-depth conversations about trendy stuff like football data and geekery, then you can listen to John McKenzie on the TIFO Talks podcast with the lovely Dan Pelchin. Go and listen to that. JJ Bull the Bullard, thanking you.
What's the dick?
You're just switching off a good lot.
I don't know what happened. Yes, thank you. Bye. Yeah.
And John McKenzie, thank you. Producer Jamie, thank you very much. Yes, there he goes. And of course, Steve Hankles, our pride and joy, our very own little Mr. Wall, you know? See you later, Steve.
See ya.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, before we go, that clip that Steve was talking about before, the snippet from Away From Home, you can listen to that now. So we'll fade out and you'll be listening to the sounds of that. Audio only. you video people don't get that, but you did get a nice little snippet behind the scenes. There we go. Anyway, see you later, video people. Bye bye bye.
Bye, video people. Bye.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, yeah. Of course. You can ask a question. I try to answer.
Sure. So I suppose to begin, can you explain the past couple of days, how you are, and also if your family is okay, first of all?
Yes. In the morning of 24th of the February, we walked up after the sounds of bombs. And went to basement.
This is the captain of Ukrainian football club Shakhtar Donetsk. His name is Taras Stepanenko, and he's one of the most famous footballers in his country. He was born before the collapse of the Soviet Union. He played over 70 times for Ukraine, and he's been with his club since 2010. I called him as war broke out to learn what was happening firsthand.
Multiple attacks on cities right across the country. The foreign minister, Dmytro Kuleba, has just tweeted that the country is under full-scale invasion by Russia.
I have a wife and three sons, one 7 years, one 8, and one 4.
Okay. What do you tell them?
My wife scared so much, and we started to read news. But my sons, they don't understand clearly what happened. Now I think they're scared too.
Stepanenko's life changed, like so many other Ukrainians did, when Russia invaded the country in early 2022. But 6 months on, unlike most men his age, he's fortunate enough to do his normal job again, to play football, and to play in the Champions League, where the best teams from across the continent face off to be crowned kings of Europe. For Ukraine, football is more than a sport now. It's a unifier. It's a statement to the world that they are strong, and Shakhtar Donetsk is the embodiment of that sentiment.
We are showing to all the world that we are still alive.
Nothing cannot kill us. We are in the war for 2014. It will be difficult to play, but we must play. Unfortunately, we are thinking just about Ukraine now. And if this fucking bastard from Russia think that we will stop to play because of that, we will not stop to play. We'll play, and we'll win.
For The Athletic, I'm Adam Crafton. Over the course of this series, I'll be tracking Shakhtar's unique football journey as they navigate their way through football's toughest contest, all whilst there's a brutal war raging on their doorstep, forcing them out of their own country.
You didn't sleep, you cannot sleep. 3 days without sleep.
I'm proud that I'm part of this team, of this club. And today we can be proud because this victory is for Ukrainian people, for Ukrainian citizens.
It's not only about football now, it's about to show that we are fighting, that we are still alive.
This is Away From Home, Episode 1, We Believe in Miracles.